Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is Gina Gatta, who owns Damron.com. So welcome to the show, Gina.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. I'm particularly interested to find out from you. I know you have a history with your connection with Damron's, knowing about gay bars all over the country. But one thing I'd really like to know is if you could tell us about your very first gay bar experience.
Well, I was living on 14th and in San Francisco on 14th and Dolores. And I walked down to Amelia's on Valencia, Amelia's bar. And I walked in there. I was not legal, but I had a fake ID. I was 19 years old. It was 1983. And I walked into Amelia's and realized that everybody looked just like me. And it was, so that was, even though I had some experience going to the Trocadero and dancing before, or being at, in mixed bars, it was the first time I had gone in and, you know, I was wearing a polo shirt and to topsiders, and so was everybody else. Met probably my first girlfriend there with a group of friends, and that's how it all started.
So what was Amelia's like? Like, describe it to somebody that has
Amelia's was like the, well, it was the bar. It was, you know, Ricky Stryker was a legendary business owner in San Francisco. She owned both Maud's in the Hate and Amelia's, and I think she owned something else prior to that as well. She owned a place over on near Mission Rock. I forgot the name of it, but it was like a restaurant for the longshoremen. So it was very mixed. It was like a picnic restaurant, but then also they could knock down some tables and make a dance floor for lesbian parties. So Ricky Stryker owned it. So it was like, it had its butch element, because back then it was more butch. Clementinas came in later for San Francisco to be more like mixed butch and femme. But it was the bar you walk right into, and it's a downstairs bar, and always packed. And then you would go in the back and they go up the stairs, and upstairs would be another bar and a dance floor with the ceiling super low. And it was packed nonstop. It was just packed all day, all night. It was more the nighttime bar, Amelia's. Maud's would be more of a daytime bar, because they had over at Maud's, they would have a patio. So people would go outside in the afternoon.
Now, you mentioned that Amelia's was kind of oriented toward the butch lesbian. And at that time in the early 1980s and before then, there seemed to be a lot of segregation in the lesbian community bars between, you know, butch and femme. Was that generally the case in San Francisco at that time, or is that just that particular?
No, that was the case in the lesbian community. I mean, there were definitely femme women at the bar, and I think women, as the 80s developed, and I was very involved with a woman who was straight before she was gay, and she was very feminine. And I think as the 80s went on, women were more, felt like they could live their life as a feminine woman, and not feel like they had to be in a shoebox and look like me with short hair and a polo shirt on. So I think that as the lesbian community developed, but you know, there's always that. If you look at the old school black and white of the gay bars in New York City, you would always have a couple. The woman, there would always be a butch and a femme couple. They would never be two butches together in those early days before Stonewall. I think that we gradually grew out of that in the 70s with all the hippie stuff. I think that it became more and more welcoming and more. And then there were a lot of theme parties would be like butch femme parties, or, and it was spoken more and it was more open. And it was very... Back when I first came to San Francisco, it was very segregated, that lesbians and gay men did not mix very well together. And gay men did not welcome even drag queens or transgender people into bars. I mean, I remember trying to bring a woman in heels into the Detour, and they wouldn't let me in because she had heels on. They were just unfriendly towards the mix, unlike small town bars where everybody would come together because it was just a place where everybody would meet. In San Francisco, we were so lucky at that time to have so many bars that people did segregate.
Now, you mentioned that San Francisco had a lot of gay bars back, you know, in the 70s and 80s, yet there are only a handful of lesbian bars at that time, especially compared to the relative number of what would be described more as men's bars in that same environment. Why do you think that is? I mean,
it's been like that all through the gay bar history. It's always been like, you know, 70% men, 30% women. It's just the way the business world has worked. And it's also the way that when lesbians go to bars, you got to realize lesbians go to, and women and men, let's look at the way they roll. Men go to bars to hook up. Men go to bars to have sex. So they go to a bar, they hook up, they have sex, and then they go back the next night and they find a new guy, hook up, have sex. Lesbians go to bars, meet somebody, fall in love, get married. So they are not promiscuous. Like they were not, you know, that's how it was. And that's how it is in the women's community. And that's why women's bars don't sustain and because people go there to meet somebody to be forever with. Men go there to meet somebody to be tonight with.
Absolutely. In fact, I think that's where that whole stereotypical second lesbian date at the U-Haul concept came up was, you know,
right,
because of that. And of course, we're experiencing now, you know, fast forward to 2021, where there's only a handful of lesbian bars in the entire country that even still exist,
right?
Which, you know, says something about the community itself.
Right.
Now, do you think the fact that there was, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of lesbian couples were one butch, one femme. Do you think that was because we were so early in the days of public acceptance that it was a sort of attempt, whether conscious or not, to be heteronormative, to kind of appear that there was a male and female in the couple?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And even, you know, even into the aughts when I would travel with my partner, you know, they would just think we were a straight couple. And that's fine most of the time. You know, I don't really care. We get treated better, unfortunately. But I didn't do it because I had to. I was also involved with a girl that was really butch for 12 years. So, you know, I think that, back then it was like, that was just the way it was supposed to go. Two femmes were supposed to be together. Two butches were supposed to be together, but thankfully that's all changed.
Right. There's been a lot of changes in our community. And back then, you know, I was in the gay publishing business locally in Atlanta, back in the late 80s, and everything was gay to me then. You know, lesbians were gay. Gay men were gay. There was no division as there is now. We have so many labels and so many identities. But back then, you know, even the national activist organizations often use the term gay as part of their name. So things have changed quite a bit since then.
Right.
So after you went to Amelia's and kind of experienced the fact that there was a whole world out there of people like you, that you could fit in and be a part of a community and not be some sort of an outlier. You later experienced kind of the opposite end of the gay bar spectrum when you visited Trocadero. What was that like for you as compared to going to the intimate lesbian bar?
Well, the Trocadero was my first experience because my brother was, a bartender there, and, I have two gay brothers, and I was living with this one gay brother, and I was also, and his roommate also was a bartender. I knew all the bartenders. So I, again, with my illegal underage ID, became a regular there and met a lot of people and experienced a lot of, you know, wild, wild nights. On the dance floor, really learned how to improve. That's where I would appreciate music. You know, I always appreciated gay men's music better than lesbian music. I enjoy dancing and being around gay men more than I like being around, lesbian bars. because it's where I grew up. I grew up at the Trocadero. I was 19 and I was there every weekend. And that was my experience, and it was wild. I mean, it was, you know, it was, there was no doors on the bathrooms, and it was just, yeah, there was, you know, that was just such an awakening in being so open and wild and free sexually and lots of drugs. And then when you go to the lesbian bar, more conservative drinkers, more hostile, because when you drink, there's a little more fights. When you do ecstasy or you do MDA, you're a lot happier. So that always played a part for me, that why I enjoy being around gay men more. And the diversity, you know, I mean, it's like I had a transgendered partner there for a while. And then, like I said, I met my straight girlfriend, and then we were together for 12 years as well. So it was a fabulous time. It was a magical time, and it was right in, but it was the beginning of AIDS. So it was also, that also brought me into where I went with my investment into the gay community, as I started taking care of my brother's friends who were dying. And that's where I was in the 80s. I mean, I was deep in it.
Did you feel at that time that there was more cohesion in the male community, in the gay male community, because of AIDS? Because I know,
largely, I think there was more acceptance to lesbians in the gay men's world because we were the ones taking care of them. I think that broke down a lot of barriers, because it was the women that were taking care of the guys that were dying. It was the women that were working in Ward 5B, the female nurses there, the women doing body work on people with KS that nobody else would touch. So I think that gay men really started to appreciate lesbians more because of our commitment to the care of AIDS and HIV, people with HIV.
Now, Trocadero was a huge difference from your typical, you know, gay or lesbian bar. How would you describe Trocadero to somebody who's never seen it?
Bacchanal of Studio 54 of San Francisco. I mean, that's where the stars would be. I mean, I would be, you know, I thought this, I was up in the manager's office, and it's like this African-American chick was up there, and I'm like, thought she was a drag queen. It was really Grace Jones. You know, and I was like, I thought she was totally a drag queen. I had no idea it was really Grace Jones. Everybody was Trocadero. Madonna was there. You know, I mean, it was the Studio 54 of San Francisco. So, you know, that we, and you had to be a member. I had my membership card, or like, I also was on the ins because my brother was the manager. My brother at that point had become a manager there. So it was, and every night was the theme. It was like, it wasn't just let's turn on the lights. We're talking about decor. Every theme, that's where the red parties, the black parties, the green parties, all that was born, where the Saint was doing it in New York, where we, that's how we were doing it here. You know, Dick Collier, the owner, was, you know, he was a difficult guy, but he did spend money. But he also had people like my brother and Danny and Brian that were very talented set makers. So it was a 24-hour, and it went on all night, and it went on, you know, it started at midnight and then it would go on until noon the next day. And they had these skylights that they would cover up, and every once in a while they'd open them a little bit and everybody would freak out. It was very dramatic, very, very dramatic. It was a production.
I think a lot of younger people don't realize that back in the 70s and 80s, there was a lot of theater involved with the bigger gay bars, the ones that kind of came out of the disco era, which I think set the stage for that. Because before the disco era, we didn't really have bars like that. And then once disco kind of set in and you started seeing these big productions and, you know, larger bars with larger dance floors, you started to get more of that theatrics. And I think that was a big draw for a lot of people and kind of an eye opener for the gay community.
Yeah.
I mean, I know personally, I was in awe the first time I went into a large disco like that. And I thought, wow, you know, we can have these places. not all of our gay bars are dark, dingy little holes in the wall with six bar stools and a grumpy bartender. So it was kind of an eye opener to the community.
Right. Well, you know, like, you know, places like Milwaukee had Lacage, you know, LA had Probe. I mean, we had big, big places, you know, there was Studio One in LA for a while, you know, so I think, you know, and then of course out in the South, there was a lot of big drag queens, as you know, being in, from Atlanta. So the production value for those shows were great.
Oh, absolutely. When I moved to Atlanta, we had Sweet Gumhead, Backstreet. There had been a bar there called the Showcase Cabaret. There were numerous bars, Magic Garden, Hollywood Hops. So there were quite a few that had huge production, drag numbers and performance, you know, elements to the bar itself.
Right.
It was pretty dynamic.
Yep.
Now, not too many years after your first experience in the gay bar industry and experiencing gay bars for yourself, you kind of got connected with something that for people in my generation and maybe the generation or two that followed was a staple in the gay community. You started working for Bob Dameron's address book, his guidebook, and you were still relatively new to the gay scene. I mean, you had only been out for about 6 years.
I was 25. It was 1989. And I was 25, just about. And my friend Dan Delbex had bought Dameron from Bob in 1986 or seven. So he had only owned it a couple of years. And then Bob died around that time too. Bob died probably around 88, 89. I'm not firm on that number. And then I started in 89 and then Dan died in 91. So I was left in charge. My other gay brother came down to help me, who knew Dan for many, many years while Dan was sick. And also another guy that used to own The Advocate came in and helped with the transition. The company was left in trust with about $250,000 debt. And back then, that was a lot of money. And we had to come out of the trust after 5 years, which we did. And I eventually bought out everybody and own it. But it was, you know, and, you know, when I started in 89, there was... Dan had just hired a woman from who used to do places of interest for women with Marianne Ferrari. It was her ex-lover. He brought her over from and to start the Woman's Traveler. So I was on the team for the first Woman's Traveler. And then once we did the Woman's Traveler, then we started with the Dameron Road Atlas, the Dameron Accommodation Guide. And our first international guide was Dameron Amsterdam. And we were going really well into the 90s with productions and, you know, selling 50,000 copies of the men's guide, Dameron address book each year. I mean, we were very, very, the growth was incredible until 1999. And then the internet happened.
Well, now what a lot of people don't realize, I know most people over 40 in the gay community are familiar with the Dameron name because it was our Bible. It was the source of finding information about gay venues around the country. So anytime you were going to go travel somewhere, you would go to your local gay bookstore or gay bar or wherever you could get it and pick up a Dameron's guide so that you could at least get an idea of where to go when you were in Mobile or you were in New Orleans or you were in Dallas. But the roots of the book start way back 25 years before you started.
It started in 1964. Yep.
And I remember you telling the story in another interview you did about 10 years ago about Bob Dameron, who I think at the time may have been a bartender in San Francisco. I don't think he'd owned a bar yet.
No, I don't know about him ever being a bartender. That's new to me. I knew he was a bar owner, so I'm sure he had to get behind the bar every once in a while. But I don't really know how he made his start. I know his house was on Noe Street, and that's where they ran the company out of. I know he had a gay brother named Nori. I know he had some other guys that were that did the books with him in the early years named Pat McAdams and somebody else. The names are all in the early books in the masthead.
And you paint this picture, it's almost like a Rockwell image of Bob Dameron piling into, I assume, an early 60s station wagon with wood grain paneling, driving around to locate the barge himself.
Right.
Is that really how it started with him driving around? And
yeah, he would travel the country. And he would travel the country because I would talk to, when I would update the books every year, I would get bartenders on the phone or bar owners on the phone because our phone bills were like $5,000 a month because that was the only way to update the books. So we had, how expensive phone calls were back then. So I would get guys on the phone and say, oh yeah, I remember Bob would come in and he's a real, tell me all about his sexual exploits and this and that. And Bob, and they knew Bob he came around, and so it's true, just like the Bible salesman. He'd go around, he'd collect all the information in a little address book, write everything down, come back to San Francisco, mimeograph it, make these little tiny books, go back on the road and distribute them at the places like the bars, mostly bars and bathhouses at that time. A couple of hotels, but hotel bathhouses. And that's how they would be distributed. And then also they were like $4 or $5. And then it was also, we always had a PO box until about 10 years ago because everything had to be on the down low. We would mail books out very discreetly we'd mail us a check and we'd mail them a book. But for those first years, probably through the beginning of the middle 70s, he was traveling around like that.
Now, what a lot of people did not know about Bob Dameron, and I only recently discovered when I interviewed Patrick Batt right there in San Francisco, who was the first manager of the San Francisco Eagle, is that Bob Dameron also owned some bars, and the Eagle in San Francisco was one of them, but he owned several other bars as well.
Yeah, he owned the PS on Polk. And a bar called Alfie's. I don't remember where Alfie's was. I can look it up in one of my books. But and the Eagle was the last one.
And it's still there.
And I think now it's been made a landmark.
Absolutely, which is a great thing.
Yeah.
My whole project has been based on the premise that throughout our gay history, we have spent so much effort in documenting, the riots, the revolutions, the political activists, all these things about our community. But yet what really made our community what it is today was the bars and the networking of the bars that was made possible by publications like Dameron's Guide.
Right.
So, that's why I'm so excited about being able to talk to people from all over the country about the gay bar experiences they had 20, 30, 40 years ago. In one case, almost 70 years ago, I interviewed a guy earlier, a couple months ago, whose first gay bar experience was 1952 in Nashville. So it's really exciting to be able to see that. And right there in your, under the umbrella of the Dameron Company, you have records of almost every gay bar that existed going back into the 60s, or as many as you could document at that time.
Right. And, and a lot of times when people would, a lot of times they didn't want to be documented. Like I would call up and say, updating a list. I don't want to be in that book. Because police departments had our books. Our books got into the hands of the wrong people. We got a lot of threat, as many letters that we got from people saying you saved our lives. We used to get letters threatening our lives. And also we depended a lot on the local publications. We had really great relationships we got all the local papers from all over the country. And we would depend on them to update it. But a lot of times, publishing a local publication is a loveless, there's no money in it really. And so we sometimes had better information than the local publications. We built a list of really good, reliable users, readers that would send us updates, snail mail, of course, that's the only way they did it. We had the guy in Florida, you had the guy in Atlanta, we had the guy over there. And we would get these letters all the time, and we would always get it. And Bob Dammit always had something in the book. Send us information we don't have, and we'll send you a free book. I would do it today if people did that, but they don't. So, I published my last book 2 years ago, and I won't be publishing any more books.
Well, I can understand that. I started in the gay publishing industry around the same time that you moved to Damron's. And I was publishing a local nightlife guide in Atlanta. It was called Ovation. Before that, it was called The Guide, which was kind of a chain. There was one in Boston, yes. One in Denver. Yep. And I was running the
one. That was a pretty good magazine. But they also had classifieds in there, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But it was a very strange market back then, because as you know, it was a strange thing back in the 80s. Every business I approached, and you as well, at that time, you were basically saying, you know, hi, I'm Art, and I'm gay. Because in order to sell your product, you have to basically out yourself. And outing yourself in the 80s was an interesting scenario.
Right. Yeah. Especially in small towns. Exactly. It was a very difficult, it was a fine line to, and then, you know, and then pushing the 90s, it was like, everybody wanted to, you know, in mid 90s, you know, everybody wanted to have a gay flag out front, late 90s, probably mid, you know, or be, yes, we're gay friendly. What does gay friendly mean?
We'll take your money.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I would always say to advertisers, you know, I'd have like these one-offs. I'd have like, you know, you'd get a gay sales manager at a Hyatt in Cincinnati. And the gay sales manager at that Hyatt, I'd meet him at an IGLTA convention, or he'd want to get his Hyatt advertised. But the big picture was that you just don't do a one-off. The gay community is smarter than that. You know, it's like they're not going to, you know, you have to have a commitment. Like, look at Subaru. Subaru had the commitment. Amtrak did it about 8 years ago, 10 years ago. Amtrak did this whole big campaign. You can't just go in there and do these one-offs. You know, it has to, because the sales manager may want to do it, but as soon as it goes to the district manager, they're going to be like, this book has sex in it.
Right.
We're not going to advertise in this book. So that was a real frustrating thing as a salesperson over the years, because, you know, you'd be just be running in circles and then going to these like gay conventions, like the IGTA used to be the Gay Travel Association. Then it became ILGTA to be more lesbian and inclusive. And I'd go to these conventions every year and, you know, everybody, all those corporate American companies would send their gay person from their team. I'd pitch them, but they weren't the one making the decision.
Right.
So then, I understand that Hyatt wants to send or Starwood wants to send their employee there to represent. But when it push comes to shove, you know, and I say, you just can't advertise, you know, gays, you need to have a commitment. You need to have a buy-in.
Right. In Europe, they have a phrase they use for that called pink washing, where corporations just kind of put on a facade of being gay friendly for the sake of revenue. And there really is no heart and soul behind it. And I think, I hate to name drop, but I think one of the big players that really broke the ice for, you know, the gay advertising community on a national level was Absolut Vodka. When they came out and they just basically threw it out there and said, we want to be gay. We'll put gay stripes on our bottle. We'll, you know, advertise in all kinds of publications. Right. And after that, you started to see other businesses on a national level kind of accept that and say, hey, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And now we have corporations. Now we have companies that go out there and teach, how to be, you know, like my friend's Hospitality Me. They go out there and they teach companies how to be inclusive and how to, you know, diversity experts now.
Right. That was a term that never existed when we were starting out.
No, it did not.
No. So you live in a city that is stereotypically gay. I mean, most people, especially in the gay community, they hear San Francisco and they have these images of, you know, Folsom Street and South of Market and Castro District gays and Leathermen and lesbians and Harvey Milk and all these images of gay history. Do you think that had a big impact on your development of the company and how everything went with Dameron, because it was kind of the safe haven of sorts?
Oh, yeah. I was constantly reminded that I was in a bubble. And it still is a bubble in a lot of ways. I mean, because of our progressive attitudes in San Francisco, it's not the gay Mecca anymore. I mean, South of Market and the Castro are pretty much, everything's gentrified. I mean, there's just no specific gay area anymore. Of course, there's still gay bars in the Castro and there's still gay bars in South of Market, but the numbers are minimal. When I would go out and go on the road to do sales, you know, and even going down to Palm Springs, you know, the segregation down there with the male only places. And I've experienced all of that. We are definitely in a bubble, and I've always had to have my team. We did have quite a big staff at one time. You know, I constantly had to remind them that, you know, people are not living there. These, you know, we are very lucky and we can be who we want to be. Most people they can only be who they are when they go to that bar. They can only be who they are when they go to that vacation. The reason people went to Key West, people, so they could be around like-minded people. They had to go back home and be straight.
Right. Life in Topeka, Kansas was not quite the same as life in the Castro District.
Yeah, exactly. Correct.
You've done all this traveling. You've been all over the country and you found all these different bars on your own as well. You know, you continued the tradition of Bob Dameron and going out and actually visiting a lot of these places, correct?
Yes.
Has that changed at all? Do you still do that? Or have you?
No.
You rely more on.
I'm done. I just, after 25 years, it got to be much. And then, I was going everywhere all the time and even internationally and everything. It was great. I feel very blessed that I had it, but not, no. In fact, you know, travel is very limited for me right now. I'm happy not to travel. And the way the world's been the last couple of years, of course not. But no, there's that those days are done. And it was great when it happened. And a lot of times I did it because I was producing new books. I was trying to do my accommodation guide. So I was going, you know, knocking on doors. I went to Berlin. I tried to get in a lesbian bar. They wouldn't let me in because they didn't think I was a girl. I've had lots of very interesting experiences at bars, some very positive and some not.
Now, one of the newest bars that's popped up on the horizon and probably one of the few substantial bars that's appeared in the last couple of years since COVID hit is a multi-story nightclub right on the edge of Hell's Kitchen in Times Square in New York City called The Q. And that club is completely different from what we saw in the 70s and 80s in the bar scene anywhere in the country. Their concept is to be all inclusive. The Q stands for queer. Do you see that as being a trend in future bars going forward?
Yes. Yeah, I definitely do. I mean, even back then in the early days, like you know, I would have straight women that would buy the Dameron guide because they wanted to go to bars that had great music and they weren't going to get hit on by, you know, and then that happened a lot in San Francisco when the whole .com thing happened and we had a bar in the Mission called Lexington Club. And the only way that they really survived is like to embrace the tech bros, to embrace those like nerdy tech guys. And lesbian, and you know, you'd never believe it 20 years earlier that lesbians would deal with like these straight dudes just hanging out with them playing pool. But that was the only way the Lexington Club could survive. You have to become inclusive, all inclusive, and diversified. It's the only way anything survives these days. I mean, unless you're the Eagle, unless you're something like Abbey, one of these bars that are so successful that they get, and the Abbey is so successful in LA because they have always been mixed like that. You know, they always had Hollywood coming in. They always had this coming in. They always had that coming in. And that's why the Abbey has been so successful over the years. And obviously this Q bar in New York City, the same thing. It is the only way that you're going to survive. And when you go to the Castro on a Saturday afternoon, you see more straight girls and straight kids mixing with gays at the brunches and all that kind of stuff. If there's going to be like three tables, there's going to be three tables, possibly one table of the same sex or all gay men, but the rest of the tables are all going to be mixed with one gay friend and straight friends. That's the only way to survive in the business right now.
And really, when you were starting with Dameron back in the 80s, that was kind of the dream. I mean, the dream was that we wouldn't need to have our own bars, that we wouldn't need to have our own restaurants. We wanted to be able to go wherever we could and be who we are. And we're starting to approach that in some more metropolitan areas, I think.
Right. And also, I think the family thing, you know, the fact of the matter that gays are not only just getting married, but having families. So, you know, people travel differently now. They travel with children. So you have to think about, okay, you know, sure, gay week at Disney used to be a circuit party, gay days at Disney. But, you know, now it's like bring your straight children, gay parents bringing their straight children to Disney to be with other like-minded families. Family week in Provincetown. I list all this. I still publish a calendar on my website, you know, listing all like the gay camps where the gay families go. So that's a whole, you know, that's a whole new marketing thing. And I did this thing with Rhodes Scholar a couple of years ago. I pitched this whole thing about doing educational trips internationally and targeting parents with, you know, gay parents with children, because that's the new, that was a, you know, that that's a huge market for travel.
Now, with all the changes that we've seen in the gay community over the past 30 or 40 years, and the changes we've seen with Dameron, you stopped publishing your women's guide about 5 years ago and your men's guide, I think, 2 years ago. Where do you see the future of Dameron being as far as helping the gay community, you know, comprehend and understand their gay options around the world?
I mean, I my resources are still there. I sell content. I still have membership based website access. That's what helps me keep the website open and keep the doors open. I am actually closing my office for this year and just going to be remote. You know, it's been bittersweet, but you know, I've had the same phone line for 30 years. That's going down. So Dameron's going to be there. The website I'll still update as I can, but it's been a labor of love for me and a hobby and not a generating income for over 10 years. So, you know, that's pretty much where we are. I mean, there's a lot of resources out there. I still have people. I just got a book sale today. I still have people buying my books, but it's an old book. The website is, I update the website as you know, quarterly. You know, I try to update it as much as I can. Like I told you, I keep the calendar up. I have a couple of paid advertisers, but it's, you know, days are numbered. Depends on what happens with me in the next couple of years, but you know, I'm committed to go through till end of 22, keep the website up until end of 22. But after that, I'm not sure.
Do you have somebody ready to step in and follow in your footsteps, or are you the end of the line?
There's other companies out there. You've got Gay Cities. You've got Scott Gatz. He's got Q Media. There's so many other resources out there. You know, if somebody wants. The company's been for sale for 35 years. So ever since I got the company's been for sale. So if somebody wants it, I'm always open to an offer, but it's going to be just what it is right now. And I'll ride it out and see how I feel a year from now.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to find one of these nonprofit archives that will take the, you know.
Oh, I have. I just donated all of my original books to, professor down at Cal State Fullerton. He's been working with me before when he was in school. He was studying gender studies. He studied the gay bar, gentrification of gay neighborhoods. He has a nonprofit that documents and mapped out all of the gay bars for all over the years. And so I donated all of my books. He just got the last box today.
Is that called Mapping the Gay Guides?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that project.
Yeah. So I donated. So my all, you know, so he'll have my, and I know Eric, and I think that he will keep the doors open for researchers. Cause over the years I've had so many researchers in here. I've had so many people doing their thesis or doing this or doing a research book, doing a history of gay bathhouses. I mean, so I know that Eric will continue to do that and open up the document, open up the data to them. Then also another avid reader is donating his entire archives of his books to one archives at USC. So I know there's going to be two sets at least of full Dameron guides out there.
Yeah, I hope they. I with the Mapping the Gay Guides project, at least that's going to be accessible online. I'm not so sure about USC's one archives, how active they are in actually getting things digitized as opposed to being physical in his four houses.
Right. I mean, no, nobody's going to sit there and take pictures of pages or photocopy pages like I did over the last 25 years to 30 years. Right. You know, I mean, yeah, but none, you know, I used to get calls every week for that. Now I hardly do. Now it's like, call Eric. And, you know, I got to let things go and see how it goes. I've tried to look into getting everything digitized. I tried to get some nonprofit. I tried to change my company to become a nonprofit to do that and to get some grants. But to change your company from a C corp to a nonprofit is outrageously expensive, and it just wasn't going to. Let somebody else try to do it. I tried.
Well, if you need any further resources, I visited recently an awesome place down in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, which is called the Stonewall National Museum.
Yeah, I know that. I know a few people on the board there, and that's a very good place. And they have a lot of my books as well.
Yeah, and Hunter Ohanian, the director there, is very keen on digitizing as much as possible.
Right. And he is affiliated with my collector in New York City that's donating to One Archives. They've worked together as well. So, yeah, there are people out there doing this work, and I hope to see that. I think Eric's going to be my best chance to get things put into digital because of his position at Cal State Fullerton and his project.
Well, I certainly hope so, because that's our future. That's the way we're going to be able to preserve our history,
right?
Is by having it digitized, having it online, and having people being able to see all the information about what's happened in the gay community. And from my perspective, particularly in the nightlife scene over the past, 50 or 60 years.
Right.
So I certainly appreciate the work that, Bob Dameron started and that you have continued for the last 25 years in preserving this information and publishing it so that it's documented for, people that come after us.
Yes.
That's a great thing that you've been doing for the past 25 years.
Yes. I feel very lucky to do that.
And I appreciate the fact that you took the time to tell us a little bit about your personal bar history with Amelia's and Trocadero and, of course, Bob Dameron's involvement in actually owning bars, which is an aspect that I don't think a lot of people know about. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're very, very welcome.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode or to find more episodes, visit GabeArchives.com.